This is an ABC podcast.
Today it's my conversation with the Irish author Marion Keyes. Marion has been really open about the tough times in her life. It's probably what lets her write characters who are as messy and believable and funny as the ones that fill her novels. Marion is one of the most successful Irish novelists ever. She was brought up in a family who loved telling stories, but Marion never even considered that she could write fiction herself. First, she studied law and then accountancy until life pushed her into doing what she really wanted, writing. In 2009, she experienced a major depressive episode, and for that, it was baking cakes that got her through. She wrote an autobiography about that called Saved by Cake. I spoke to Marion last year when she published her most recent novel, The Break, and our conversation was recorded with a very enthusiastic audience at the Greek Club in Brisbane. So The Break tells the story of a woman, Amy, whose husband, Hugh, asks for a six-month break from their marriage. Did writing about this scenario make you reconsider anything in your own marriage?
Not initially, it didn't. I would be very, very against the idea of a break. I'm extremely fond of himself, and I like to know where he is at all times. And it's funny, he's after buying me a piece of software, so when he goes off running, which he does regularly, I can actually trace his path. But this is only in Ireland. And in recent years, he's taken to climbing mountains in faraway exotic locations. And just when I was finishing the break, he went off to Kenya, to climb Mount Kenya. This was at Christmas last year. And whenever he goes away on these trips, I'm always very, very interested in how many women are going to be in the group. And I'm always hoping that the answer will be zero. And so he was going to Kenya, and we were going to be out of phone coverage for 12 days. And so we spoke when he landed in Nairobi, and that was our last chance for the 12 days. And so I says to him, how many people are in the group? And he goes, two, and the guide. And I said, and are any of them women? And he goes, yeah, the guide. I thought, oh my God, because the guide, you know, she was going to be young, she was going to be strong, she was going to be muscly, she was going to be brave and, you know, fearless, and, you know, she was going to be able to chip holes in the granite like he can, and they'd be, you know, held together by ropes. And the very last thing I asked him before we got cut off was, what nationality is she? Because I realised that I had some sort of sexy nations league in my head. And he said Kenyan. And then click, nee. And then I realised that Kenyan was actually very high on my list of sexy nations, because I'd been to Kenya and I'd met the Maasai women, and they're amazing. You know, they're all about 8 foot tall and really slender and fabulous. And yeah, so while he was gone, I was convinced he was never coming back, because I thought they're bound to fall in love, because A, he loves the mountains, and B, I don't, you know, so... If he meets a woman who loves the mountains as much as he does, of course he's going to fall in love. They've 12 days together, held together by a rope. And so I went over to talk to Mammy Keyes, who is very wise, but can be also quite cruel in her wisdom. And so she started by saying kind things, like saying, well, if he didn't leave you when you were mad in the head, he's hardly likely to leave you now. So this was good. This was good news. And then she starts thinking, and then she goes, although he does love them mountains. And, you know, if he lived there, they could set up a travel agency together, him and the girl. And he'd be living his best life. Because clearly she'd heard that saying somewhere, and this was her chance to use it. So... No, but I was in the horrors. I was fully convinced he was never coming back. And this will show you how kind of gruesome and distorted my priorities are. Because we work together. First of all, well, before I went on Match.com and Tinder, I started Googling personal assistants, you know. So, and also I started Googling housekeepers, because I can do nothing. You know, he does all of that. But anyway, as it happened, he did come back. He didn't leave me. But when he came back, it turned out that the second person on the climb had also been a woman. He'd been away with two of them. And you know what? It was just as well I didn't know. He did the right thing in not telling me. But so, no, that is a very long answer to your question of, no, I would not like to take a break from my marriage. Thanks very much.
Well, tell me about Hugh in your novel. Why does he want to take a break?
He's a really good man. You know, when you read about midlife crises, and the men are always presented as idiotic fools who have like suddenly decided to splash their pension money and buy a red Ferrari and they've run off with some 19-year-old. Do you know, he's not like that. He's a good man. But his dad died and then a friend of his died. So he has been confronted with his own mortality. And he has suddenly kind of realised on a cellular level that you only get one life. And there was a kind of a part of his life that he missed out on. Like when he met Amy, Amy already had a daughter. So very quickly he had a ready-made family. So he never had that kind of early marriage kind of freedom bit. Like he loves her and it's killing him to hurt her. But he feels that if he doesn't get this opportunity to be single again, that he's just not going to be able to carry on. And the thing is, it's not as implausible as it sounds, because the whole idea of marriage sabbatical is actually a thing now. Apparently it started in San Francisco, where all of that kind of dirty carry-on starts. But like sooner or later, whatever it starts over there kind of starts trickling over to the rest of us less dirty nations. And some of the marriage sabbaticals are kind of very benign. You know, people go traveling or they go back to university or they, you know, they take 3 months and they go on a yoga retreat or they do something they always wanted to do. But sometimes the sabbaticals are sabbaticals with benefits.
Amy, though, also wonders about what her responsibility is in their marriage coming to this sort of impasse, because she was involved in a fairly heavy-duty flirtation situation with a colleague. And do you think she was having the same kind of midlife concerns or anxieties that that Hugh was in the novel?
Well, the thing is, I think we're all nuanced. Like, none of us are perfect. And, like, no matter how much you love somebody, it's always kind of, well, I get surprised if ever anyone gives me the glad eye. I'm thinking, Jesus, what's wrong? You know, but for most people, if somebody kind of, you know, smiles at you or, you know, kind of said, you know, makes you feel good about yourself, it does. There's a part of me, I suppose, that kind of feels, oh, that was very nice. You know, like, and I have a friend who says that she never feels normal unless she has a work flirtation. And like, she's happily married and everything. So I suppose in every marriage, you go through times where you're very connected and times when you are not connected at all, but you're still held together in a routine and living in the same house. So I think I wanted to write a realistic novel about a long-term relationship and to acknowledge that it's not one steady line of delightfully comfortable loveliness all the time, you know. And, like, sometimes you're together and sometimes you're not.
Another of the characters in The Break gets pregnant while she's in her final year at school and she wants an abortion. What does that mean for a woman in Ireland?
If a woman in Ireland gets pregnant and needs an abortion, if she manages to buy illegal abortion pills and is caught taking them, she is liable for 14 years in prison. That's even if she's been raped. She will get longer in prison than her rapist will. It's so shocking. Abortion isn't available in cases of incest. In cases of fatal fetal abnormality, women are obliged to carry their babies to term and their babies die in terrible distress because the trauma of labour kills them. I really feel that, like, anybody who ever needs an abortion, it's never an easy decision. It's fraught and it's sad and it's painful and it's frightening. But in Ireland, women have to leave the country. They travel to Britain or Holland. They choose Holland because of the price, because, you know, it's very expensive. The travel involved, the cost of the treatment. And at least one woman that we know of has died making the journey back. So at the moment, there has been a real upsurge in energy, like from young women, feminists, which is just so wonderful, because somebody of my generation, I was brought up with an awful lot of shame and an awful lot of fear about challenging, you know, it's basically, you know, a theocratic orthodoxy, but they have been very energetic. So we're having a referendum in the hope of overturning the clause in our constitution that makes it illegal, and hopefully Irish women will be able to access full reproductive health care in their own country. And the reason I wrote about it was obviously because it's important to Irish women, but also increasingly it's become very important on a global scale, because in Trump's America, the Christian right are pushing back very hard. There was a huge amount of money going into rolling back the rights that women have. And already in three states, in South Dakota, in Texas, and in Idaho, abortion is all but illegal. And, you know, I think we take our rights for granted. Anything women have won has been so hard fought that we sort of think they'll never take it away from us. It can be taken away from us. So I wanted to kind of urge vigilance on a global scale that, like, things are changing and we need to be careful.
Looking at Ireland in particular, from the outside, say with the gay marriage vote, it looks like so much has changed. Does it feel like that on the inside, that the power of the Catholic Church is shifting?
Not really. With women, I cannot tell you how utterly joyous it was to be the first country in the world to legalise same-sex marriage by popular vote. I mean, it was just utterly amazing. Like, the campaign was bitter, but the overall vote, it wasn't exactly a landslide, but it was, you know, two-thirds to one-third. And people can't understand how, if we legalise same-sex marriage, that women are still treated so badly. But it is very much that Catholic thing of a woman cannot be a sexual creature, you know, that you are either a Madonna or a whore. And I mean, that very much, that toxic attitude is what underlies so much of the laws that relate to women and how they don't have full rights over their body. On the other hand, though, I do think the Irish people are a lot more compassionate than they used to be. Like, the church still, they run 92% of Irish schools. They sit on the boards of all our hospitals. You know, people mightn't be going to Mass in the same numbers that they used to, but behind the scenes, the power is still being wielded. So yes and no is kind of my answer to you. Hmm. Some things have changed. I think the people have changed, but the power brokers haven't.
With that yes and no, that double pull, does that also speak to your decision to live in Ireland? I mean, you're there voluntarily.
Yeah.
It must be somewhere you love as well as somewhere you criticise.
Yeah, it's so funny because I love Ireland. Like, I lived in London for a long time and I love London as well, especially for the shoe shops. But but there is something about landing in Ireland. People talk to you, like, from the word go, from the man at the passport office. Like, he'll call me Marion and he'll say, welcome home, or he'll say, where have you been? And he's not doing that thing that they do, kind of trying to catch you out because they think you're a terrorist, you know? They're actually making conversation. People, they speak differently. You know, Irish people speak English differently to anyone else in the English-speaking world. It's so colourful and it's so poetic. People chat. People, I don't know, it's almost like a badge of pride that everything becomes, you know, an anecdote. Nobody can give you a yes or no answer. You know, it has to be at least 14 sentences. So I love it and I love the people. But I also think, yes, I don't like the laws, but I think I don't want to be the person who lives away from Ireland and complains about it from abroad. I want to be part of the solution. I want to live and help make changes. So I'm fully comfortable with my decision to be there.
When you mention that Irish tendency to tell a story, make a spin a story out of anything, is that something your family share, your parents, when you were growing up?
Oh, completely. Like, my mother, like, I wish you could meet her. I wish she was on Twitter. Like, I beg her to be on it, because she is feckin' hilarious. She is the funniest person I have ever met. And she can tell you the smallest stories become epics. She has that gift And she's very funny. She's very knowing as well. Like, she picks up the phrases like the living his best life. Or another thing she loves is don't be up in his face. She loves saying that. When Teddy comes over, baby Teddy, who's 2.5, when he used to be a bit smaller, like he'd be 6 months and he'd be coming and we'd be all crowding at him and she'd be shouting, don't be up in his face. Don't be up in the creator's face. You know, she's very smart. She picks up and stuff and she works it, you know. But yeah, definitely growing up in our house, like, storytelling was a competitive sport. And you had to be funny. You know, there was no good telling your story if it was as, well, I suppose, no, sorrowful was good as well, if it was very sorrowful. Yeah, but you had to, it had to be impactful. You know, you had to move your audience. You had to make them laugh or you had to make them cry. And if you didn't, you were nobody, not in our house, you know. And so I have a sister, Katrina, who's next in line to me. And she would, you would be crying. You would be begging her to stop, you know, from talking because she is so funny. So yeah, it was definitely a thing.
So whereabouts did you grow up? What part of Ireland?
Kind of all over. I was born in Limerick, where my dad was from. But then we moved to Cork when I was 3 months old. And that was like, I don't know, 80 miles away. But it felt like, you know, as far away as the moon. So I lived there till I was 8. And then we moved to Cavan, which was like, I don't know, 110 miles away. And that was like even further. That was Mars. You know, and then we were in Galway. Then when I was 11, we moved to Dublin. And then when I was 22, I moved to London. So I kind of feel... It's funny, I mean, I know I'm Irish, but I don't actually know what part of Ireland I'm from, which is a weird kind of a feeling. I've always felt like an outsider, which is not a pleasant feeling, really, but it's a wonderful feeling as a writer, because it means that you're always sort of at one remove, so you're always observing.
What did your parents want for you when you were growing up?
Well, yeah... They wanted me to be meek and well-behaved, to keep a low profile, to do very well in school, but never to learn to think for myself, to get a job in the civil service, something that was permanent and pensionable. They were like, permanent and pensionable, like it runs through their veins. They wanted us to be safe because both my parents came from poverty and education was my dad's way out of poverty. And also, I suppose, because they came from poverty, they both had a sense of don't get above yourself. They had low self-esteem. So they wanted us to be safe, but they didn't want us to be too ambitious because they didn't want us to get into trouble. You know, they didn't want us to kind of get into choppy waters.
You kind of managed to live up to that pretty well. You did
yeah,
well.
I was
you
good
studied
at
hard.
School.
So you were meeting those expectations on the outside. What was going on the inside of young Marion?
I was completely without hope. I mean, yeah, I was meeting the expectations. But like from very early on, I kind of thought nothing nice would ever happen to me. I know that sounds self-pitying. I don't mean it like that. I think I was prone to depression from a very young age. And, you know, it's no secret, like my mother suffers from depression. And I do think it's genetic. I couldn't imagine ever being happy. I couldn't ever imagine meeting a nice man. And I couldn't imagine... I don't know, living a kind of a respectable, decent life. And I had no idea what I wanted to be when I left school. Like, my future was a blank. And when I left school, I got the right marks to go to university to study law. And my poor parents, they were so delighted. I was the first one of the family to go to third level education. But I knew that I would never be able to work in that field because I didn't feel good enough. And sure enough, like, when I got my degree... I went to London and became a waitress. And it's like I self-sabotaged all the way.
Was it self-sabotage or like stepping through a window when you knew you didn't want to be in that room?
It was a bit of both. I mean, at the time, I mean, that was kind of the mid-80s, Ireland was a fully functioning theocracy. I felt like I was choking. Like, I literally felt like I couldn't breathe a lot of the time. And so running away to London was like the greatest freedom because nobody knew me. Like, I could be anybody I wanted. You know, I could even be myself for a while.
And what was life like in London?
Well, it was in many ways great fun, except I had... a very kind of well-developed alcoholism problem. I drank my way through my 20s. And like for a lot of the time, it seemed like fun. I shared a flat with two other girls and like, you know, every Saturday morning, like it was debrief time and like, you know, who's your man and where'd you find him last night? And, you know, where did you end up? And, you know, for a lot of the time, it was possible to make it funny. But by the end of my 20s, it wasn't funny anymore. And everybody that I drank with, they were doing really bizarre things like, you know, buying couches and buying curtains to match the couches. And, you know, they were getting promoted and they were becoming adults. And I still couldn't envisage ever being an adult. And suddenly I was 30.
When you look back at that time now, do you see the drinking as a symptom or as a cause? Like, were you drinking because of those feelings of fear and hopelessness, or was the drinking just blotting out everything else?
Oh, they both went together. I mean, like, as far as I'm concerned, alcoholism is a disease. Like, I never felt normal, and I never felt the same as other people. I never felt as good as. I mean, I've heard so many other alcoholics describe it like that, that the minute they discovered alcohol, they suddenly felt the way they thought normal people felt. You know, that was exactly how I felt. Alcohol was my best friend. But I've heard people say, like, alcohol taught me how to fly, and then it took away the sky. You know, it was my best friend, and it became my worst enemy. But it was a slow process. But those feelings, alcohol took them away. But the feelings were there before the alcohol, you know, and if it hadn't been alcohol, it would have been something else. Like, I was destined to go that route. There's no doubt in my mind.
Were you aware that the drinking had become a problem?
No. I mean, I knew that I was very unhappy, and I knew that my life was a disaster. But I actually thought alcohol was the only thing that was keeping me from spinning completely off the rails. I thought if it wasn't for it, I just wouldn't be able to cope at all. Whereas everybody else, I mean, it was classic denial. You know the way you hear about denial, but nobody ever really believes it's a real thing. It was completely real. And everyone else around me knew that that's what it was.
So what brought that period in your life to an end, Marion?
I woke up one Monday morning and I just knew I couldn't do it anymore. It was luck. It was a moment of clarity. And I knew that it was something to do, that my drinking was not normal. And I made a phone call and I ended up in rehab. That was 23 and a half years ago. And I got well, you know, and everything changed. Like, I haven't had a drink since. And I've learnt how to live in a very different way. And I just feel immensely lucky. Like, at the time, I felt 30 was way too young. I was thinking, feck this, you know, if I'd handled it right, I could have knocked another good 25 years of drinking out of this. I was raging that I, you know, it had gone wrong so young. Now I feel so grateful that I got into recovery so young, because I still had lots of time to live normally, properly, respectably, healthily.
At this point in your life, when you'd spent your 20s sort of partying and drinking and then realising that the drinking was a problem in and of itself, were you writing as well?
No, I had started writing when just two weeks after my 30th birthday. I had never written a thing. I mean, I just didn't think that you could. You know, I thought people who were writers were posh people who lived in houses with big mahogany desks, and they were called Rupert or George, and that they wore glasses, and that when people asked them something, they'd take off their glasses really slowly and they'd say, "I'm glad you asked me that question, Tarquin." You know, I thought the likes of me had no business doing something like that. But I started writing short stories about 4 months before the final crash and burn. So I do think there was a connection, because I was very suicidal. I was without hope. I could see nothing good ever happening for me. You know, my glittering future was far behind me. And I do think something really, really deep in me said, "I can offer you this. Will you stay alive if I give you this?" And it was amazing, because I had never done anything before that I was proud of. Because as soon as I had done something, the minute it was associated with me, it felt contaminated. But this was different. And so when I came out of rehab, I thought, I'm going to try this because it gave me pleasure. And there was something about it that made me think, I am good enough. You know, my voice is okay. I don't know, it was weird because I'd never thought like that before.
But you found yourself picking up a pen and writing.
Yeah.
And what were you writing about? What were those first forays?
They were quite weird, to be honest with you. But they were comic, which was good because that's who I am. You know, like one of them was about, I mean, it sounds sad and it sort of is. It's about a woman who has died and she's walking around in her own life and she doesn't know she's dead. I mean, that was very much a description of my state of mind at the time. But most of them were kind of upbeat. They were quirky and they were whimsical. And I indulged myself. And I suppose they were about women like me. They were messy women living messy lives, although not as messy as mine, because that was going too far.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
One of the really distinctive things about your books is this voice that's there straight away, you know, the accent, the language, the words, you know you're in a Marion Keyes novel. Did you have that straight away, do you think,
in those words? Yeah, I did, because I didn't know any other way to be. I wanted to write as I spoke. I wanted to talk to women. This was kind of the mid-early 90s, and we were described as post-feminists at the time, where, like, we were told, it's all grand now, you're equal, glass ceilings, no such thing, equal pay, you're all grand, no sexual harassment, everything is lovely. I and my friends knew that that was a load of codswallop, but there was nothing in popular fiction addressing that. It was all about boardroom takeovers and women being fabulous, and I was thinking, where are the women like me? So I thought, I'm going to write something that I want to read. And my voice was the only one I have, which is very similar to my speaking voice. It's chatty, it rambles, it goes off on tangents. And mercifully, people liked it, you know, because if they didn't, I have nothing else up my sleeve. This is all I've got.
You started sending your work off to publishers, and I think you told a publisher that you had a novel ready. How far into that novel were you?
I wasn't anyway into it. I sent off short stories to an Irish publisher and I said I had written part of a novel, which I had no intention ever of doing because I thought, God almighty, you'd be writing that for ages. Like, it could be like months or even a year, I was thinking. And I thought, no, I'm grand with the short stories. I like them because they're short. The clue is in the name. But they wrote back and they said, we'd like to see this novel. And I was terrified. But there's a fear can be a great motivator, you know. So I didn't have time to sit down and agonise with my head in my hands. And in a week, I wrote the first four chapters of what eventually became Watermelon. And I sent it off. They said, that's grand, write more and we'll give you a contract. And like, it was bizarrely lucky, you know, and most people, it doesn't happen that fast. And I would say to anyone trying to get published, don't mind me, you know, like, keep at it. Most people, it's a lot tougher. I just, you know, all my luck came at once, basically.
And then your luck really came. It had such a great response, and that response grew with further books. When you felt brave enough to give up your day job, how did your family react?
Oh my God, they were horrified. Like, my dad in particular thought it was the worst decision ever. You know, like, you big Aegis, you're getting a lovely monthly paycheck. And also, he was the kind of father that protected me from life's hardships by catastrophizing about absolutely everything. And I remember on my first wedding anniversary, he rang me to say, hello, Mar. That's how he talks. Hello, Mar. Your book is number one, but look it, there's some Bridget Jones yoke. And look it, it's flying out of the shops. It's flying. I was talking to the man. He says it's flying. She's outselling you 10 to 1. Just prepare yourself now because, you know, they won't be buying you anymore. Like, Like, so this was what we got all our lives, you know? So, like, this was his way. He anticipated disaster at every turn. So I am also a world-class catastrophizer, but I have to say, like, he is the gold standard. But yeah, they were horrified, really shocked.
And when your dad said that, I mean, how did you react? Were you hurt or you knew?
I was.
To laugh it off?
Yeah, well, I thought, A, feck him. B, God love him, he means well. And then I thought, C, one day this will make a funny story. And sure, look it, didn't it? You know.
So life was going very well for you,
yeah.
Marianne Keyes. You know, your books are selling, you have your lovely husband, Tony. What happened then in 2009?
It's very hard to describe. I don't exactly know what happened. But one afternoon, I was at a barbecue. Actually, yeah, Sunday afternoon. And I started feeling intense anxiety. And I was with lovely people. And I remember Kathy Kelly was there, you know, the author Kathy Kelly. And I remember saying to her, Kathy, I feel really, really anxious and I don't know why. And very quickly, I spiraled into the most horrific state of mind. Extreme fear. I had some sort of breakdown. People ask what triggered it. I have no answer. I mean, we talk about mental health and mental illness, and if depression is an illness, maybe there isn't a cause. I mean, there isn't a cause, a known cause for all physical illnesses. And I was in the middle of a book tour, and I thought it was just the stress of all of that. And I thought when it ended, which was about a month later, that I'd calm down. But the fear intensified, and I went away on holidays to Thailand, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And it continued like that.
What did it feel like inside your head? What was going on?
It felt like I didn't recognize anyone. I mean, logically, cognitively, I knew that they were like, I could look at my husband and I knew that he was him. But emotionally, I had lost connection to everyone. I mean, I didn't recognize my own face in the mirror. Like, it was incredibly frightening. And I wanted to go home, but then when I got home, home didn't feel like home. It was just extreme fear and extreme disconnection and real horrible isolation. It felt, and please don't laugh, but it felt like being in a science fiction film where I had been put on another planet that was identical to Earth, and that the people in it were identical to the people I knew, but they weren't them. That's the best way to describe
it. Sounds just terrifying.
And like, it really was. It was so frightening. You know, I went to a doctor and I ended up in a psychiatric hospital, and that just made me feel worse. And I spent, the whole thing went on from start to finish for 4.5 years. But I think like the first 18 months were the really tough ones, where I felt kind of compulsively suicidal because I was so frightened. And everything that people suggested, I tried, you know. And I was put on like 4 million different kinds of medication. And for me, the medication didn't help. But I did, you know, and I tried, they say mindfulness, like, but the mindfulness made it worse for me because I had to sit with my terror. So I, who was never in any way domesticated, started baking. I say this, you know, baking, it didn't cure me. It didn't cure me, but it kept me alive because it gave me something to do. And something, it, the smallness of, I don't know, weighing butter or sieving flour. There was something lovely in that. I mean, that in a way was a mindfulness with a purpose. And so I baked, like, and it got me through. Mm.
That makes sense, the sort of following of instructions, yes, and everything feels
exactly,
meaningless.
Exactly. Yes, and then there is something magical about baking. All these weird different things, and then it's something delicious and lovely. And there's something, I don't know, very primal about feeding people, about food, that I found nice as well. So that really helped, and I feel so lucky that that found me, because I didn't find it. Like, it just landed, I had a lovely friend and she had a birthday coming up, and out of the blue I said, I'll bake you a cake, and she was like, what? You know, you? But I did, and it ran its course. Like, the baking ran its course, and eventually, and then I moved on to another sort of a craft style thing where I started painting sideboards. Basically, no furniture was safe. Like, seriously, it's called upcycling. And yeah, but like, I ran out of furniture. So my mother had a nest of three coffee tables. So I stole them from her one by one, thinking that if I took them one by one, she wouldn't really notice. But that helped as well, because I took commissions, you know. People said, you know, Oscar needs a new table to do his homework on, and so I'd paint things, and so that helped as well. But ultimately, it was the passage of time, because another thing, I mean, at one stage I couldn't even read. I couldn't even read magazines, because my eyes couldn't focus on the letters. But audible stuff helped, which is kind of a new thing to me, you know. But there was podcasts, and there was speaking books, you know. They were nice.
You're obviously so close to your family and to your husband. Was part of the trauma, in a way, seeing the effect that your darkness and your despair was having on
them? Yeah, I felt so guilty. I felt so guilty. And I wanted to be better for them. And any kind of little improvement, they all jumped all over it, and they were so pleased. And then when I'd slump back again, you know, I felt terrible shame, the failure of it. It was hard. But, you know, one of the things that really helped, even though I felt very guilty and everything, you know, my sister said to me, I'm sorry, I might cry. She said, if you kill yourself, me and Mom will never get over it. And that affected me. That went deep. You know, that was one of the things.
Just hearing it put that,
yeah,
sort of
that kind
simply
of
and straightforwardly.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought I'd never feel normal again. I thought I would never just feel normal, just wake up and not be in terror. And I feel so well now. You know, I never thought I'd be able to travel again because of the whole head wrecky stuff from the jet lag. But I can't believe I'm here in Brisbane. Like, it's 11 years. I thought I'd never get back here. And I'm here, and it just feels so great. And, no, I'm only saying it so that people will know you can get better. Like, you really can, but you must live through it. You've got to keep living, you know. Half an hour at a time was what I did, you know, when it was really bad. Half an hour, just do half an hour. And, you know, and funnily enough, I am very against that whole American thing of, you know, hey, what did you learn from that kind of really shitty experience, you know, because like they have to turn everything into a learning experience. And, you know, sometimes a shitty thing is just a shitty thing. Can you not let it alone, you know? But I have to say that I have a much more increased capacity for joy since all of this. I don't know, it broke through something. I am far better at appreciating lovely things, you know, and feeling love, kind of the capacity to love is much stronger in me now than it was. Mm. And those connections all came back, you know, so that I feel so much closer. My husband and I were always close. But that was a very dark time. But I think we're even closer now. And forgive me for going all American on you, you know, and saying, hey, we're stronger than ever. But like, but in a way we are, you know.
Well, it's a huge thing to go through and to go through with someone else.
Yeah, yeah, because it's horrible for them. Because, you know, the person he had married had disappeared. And just this, like, terrified stranger in her place.
You've been so open and so brave talking about it, writing about it. What kind of response have you had from people?
Mixed. Like, some people have been lovely, you know. And, I mean, like, I never thought it would be a big deal. But I used to write a monthly newsletter. And so when I suddenly got very sick, I had to stop. And so I put a kind of a, you know, a paragraph on my website saying, you know, I'm feeling really not well. You know, I can't sleep, I can't eat, I can't concentrate, I can't write. And, you know, and suddenly it became this big story, which shocked me. And a woman in Ireland, a journalist, wrote a piece basically saying that all that was wrong with me was self-pity. You know, she said she has a good-looking husband, she has a well-paid job and a nice house. You know, how dare she say she's depressed? And it's funny, I've only got two real grudges in my life, and she's number one on the list. And, you know, but so that, you know, people, the responses have been mixed. I mean, a lot of people have thanked me for kind of opening the discussion. And so many people have said, oh my God, me too. And it was so nice to hear somebody else talking about it. But there are other people who have never known what it's like to feel like that. You know, until I went through it, I didn't know it was possible to feel that bad. And they're going to judge. Of course they're going to judge, you know, because they can only see the outside, you know. And people are entitled to their lack of empathy. They are, apart from that journalist. And it's funny, I've stuck her in a book a couple of times since. I'd love to think that she reads and sees how unflatteringly I have depicted her.
Yeah. Well, when The Break went to number one in Ireland, Marion, what kind of celebrations were you met with from your family?
None. like, absolutely nothing. I went over on Friday night as usual. I'd gone out the night before. The bestseller results come out on a Tuesday in Ireland. And I rang Mammy Keys about something. Oh, yeah. I said, how are you, Mam? And she goes, hello. I said, listen, my book is number one. And she goes, yeah, look, are you free on Saturday afternoon? Pauline McGarry's in hospital and I need somebody to babysit Dad. And I said, Mam, my book has gone to number one. She goes, I know, how are you fixed for Saturday? And so I'd gone out for dinner on the Thursday night with my lovely friends Paul and Aoife, and they treated us to dinner to celebrate and everything. Then I go over to the Keys' house on a Friday. Nobody says a word, not a feckin' word. Like, apart from Rita Ann, no one has even read it, you know.
Like, go, Rita Ann.
Go Rita Ann, one out of five.
What, the only what's season. That about, do you reckon? Do they don't want you to be cared, or it's just like, well, you're part of the family, so they don't think of you as a work person?
That's it. I'm just part of the family. And, like, you know, I don't know much about Tighe's job.
That's what you do in your office.
The only time my mother gets involved is when I've made a show of myself again by giving out about the priests, you know. But, like, that's the only time.
You mentioned just then your mum babysitting your dad, which is what happens in this novel too. Dad has Alzheimer's, and it's really challenging for everyone, particularly for his wife. And that's something that's going on in your family.
Yeah. About 7 or 8 years ago, Dad's first started going peculiar. And I knew something was wrong. And everybody else was like, la, 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 hello trees, hello flowers, let's all dance around in denial, everything is grand. Anyway, so he had Alzheimer's. And he had always been kind of very, you know, the patriarch. He went out to work and, you know, paid the bills and, you know, was the strong figure. And she was the woman who stayed at home, and like she was made to give up her job when she got married because that's how Ireland treats women. And so she never wrote a check in her life, you know, she never did any of that stuff. And now she has, at this hour of her life, blossomed, you know, like he still lives at home. And she is so lovely to him. Like, you just would not believe how lovely she is to him. Like, I mind him on a Monday morning. Like, 10 minutes in, I want to hit him with a hammer, you know? And now, like, I have to say, I'm not going to. Don't worry, you don't have to. But, like the same questions over and 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 over again. It's hard. And she lives with that. But she takes care of herself. She goes out, you know? She goes to bridge. You know, she goes out with her friends for lunch. She goes out shopping.
One of my favourite characters in The Break is the grandma, because it's a book about reinvention and this sort of urge to make yourself over. And for Amy and Hugh, this married couple at the centre, there's a lot of pain that comes with that. But the grandma reinventing herself is just fantastic.
Yeah, well, that's again, I think, to do with our kind of extended life expectancy. We're never too old for anything. Really? Like, yeah.
Not even for tattoos?
Not even for tattoos. Yeah, I'm going to get one when I'm older.
Good.
Yeah. When I've grown up a bit more.
When you're ready. Yeah. When you can commit to a design.
Exactly. Yeah.
You don't want to regret that.
Yeah.
What about Hugh and Amy? I mean, I don't want you to give away too much of what happens in terms of the plot, but what kind of realisation do you think they come to about this idea of the break and the idea of a long-term marriage?
You see, when I was young, I used to think you got married and then you were happy forever and you never felt pain or jealousy or fear or, I don't know, fear of abandonment, insecurity. And I think that what both of them realise is that even when you marry somebody or you're with somebody that you love, you're not buffered against pain. Ultimately, and I don't mean this in a kind of a really nihilistic way, but ultimately we are all alone. And, you know, we can have a great companion to walk with us, but I am ultimately responsible for all of my unpleasant feelings. I have to deal with them. I can't expect somebody else to magic them away. It is simply impossible. I am nobody's saviour and nobody is mine. And I think when you're with somebody for a long time, you go through several versions of relationships. You kind of have to keep reinventing it. And it's the same with friendships.
It's so interesting when you talk like that, Marion. It's like you're the antithesis of the romance writer, which is, it's funny that you're sometimes thought of as sort of chick lit, because it's so unromantic. It's this idea that a sort of battered but authentic and respectful, affectionate relationship is actually a lot more meaningful than the passionate affair.
I certainly feel like that. I mean, from very early on, when I was with himself, I said, we're great companions. And people used to look at me like I don't know, like I just drowned a bag of kittens or something. They're like, companions, you know. But to have your best friend, it means so much. I mean, the flowers and the heart and the romance, it wears off. I'm sorry. Like, people say it lasts 18 months, you know, and then the chemicals in your brain change and you move on to something different, but as nice, just not maybe as fireworky, if that's the phrase.
Sounds like a Marion Keyes phrase. I believe it. You seem in such a good place now. If you were imagining Marion writing the book of your life at 80, what do you think the 80-year-old you looks like? Obviously with a tattoo. What else?
I'd be with me tattoo. I would love to think that I'm still with himself. I'd like to think that I'd have pink hair or maybe lilac or electric blue. I'd like to think that I wore long, flowing, colourful garments, and that I carried a big bag full of sweets that I ate mostly myself, but also gave to children.
Would you be writing fiction?
I would. Yeah, I'd be working with words in some way. Yeah, I would. I love words. You know, I just think they're the most beautiful things. They give me such enjoyment. You know, I think they pay me for doing this, but if they didn't, I think I'd still do it. Because I just think, I don't know, stories are beautiful, and creating a good sentence gives me such pleasure. Yeah, I think I would. I'd like some dogs as well, if that would be okay. Because I've been afraid of dogs for years. And one of the funny things about the awful time when I was like really, really bad is I was so frightened of everything that the fear of dogs left me. So there we are, another wonderful thing that came from, you know. So yeah, I'd like to have dogs, and I'd like to have great grandnieces and nephews. I'd love loads of nippers around the place. I like kids. I like badly behaved children. I do. I love them.
Badly behaved kids, dogs, sweets, purple hair.
Yeah. Sounds like. And himself.
Sounds like a fantastic. Well, let's join in wishing you that.
Oh, thank you. Thanks a million.
I spoke to Marion Keyes late last year when she published her most recent novel, The Break. And if you feel that you need to talk to someone after hearing Marion's story, then Lifeline is there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 13 11 14 is their phone number, 13 11 14. We recorded that conversation with Marion at the Greek Club in Brisbane. A big thanks to the Greek Club and to our sound engineer, Costa Zulio. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.